Hello and welcome to History Rage, the new podcast where we invite members of the historical community to get angry, to get a few things off their chest. My name is Paul Babel and I'm here with my good friend and co-host Kyle Glover.
Hello.
And this week's guest is a fellow podcaster, our first fellow podcaster. This week we welcome Dean Strachan from the Chronicler podcast. Hello Dean and welcome to the show.
Hello, Paul, and thank you for having me on the show.
You're more than welcome.
Yeah, so the Chronicler podcast is about Chinese history, and the reason why I've chosen Chinese history is because I actually live here in Beijing. When I came here 3 years ago, I started to study Chinese history, and I really got into it, and I thought, hey, why not start a podcast about it? So here I am.
Sounds good.
Well, here you are, and nice to have you here as well. So I gather today that you've not actually come to talk about your usual area of specific interest, Chinese history. You've really come to talk something more in line with, well, with your original homeland that your accent somewhat gives away. So, Dean, please, the main History Rage question is just what is the one thing that you wish people would just stop believing?
I would love for people to stop believing that Braveheart is a true story about William Wallace.
Oh, you are so preaching to the choir here now.
Yeah,
like the whole film, I think there's only a couple of things that are maybe accurate in the film. I mean, the guy was called William Wallace. They got the name right at least. But I mean,
good start.
Apart from that, it's just, yeah, I mean, it's a good start. But apart from that, like, there's so many blatant mistruths about it, and there's so many blatant, what's the word? I can't even get the words out. I'm that angry. So yeah, it's just, it's really annoying because when people talk to me about Braveheart and, you know, William Wallace, they always go to the movie and I'm like, come on, that didn't happen. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. Just shut up. So like, yeah, it gets really on my nerves when people, you know, try to talk about Braveheart as if it's like historical fact. And I mean, don't get me wrong, when historians talk about Braveheart, they know it's like all fiction. But it's just like, you know, the regular people who haven't really studied history or anything, and they just watch the movie. And don't get me wrong, the movie is entertaining. Like, it is a good movie. But apart from that, it's just, yeah, it just gets on my nerves when people seem to think that it's factual, or like some of it's factual, when the truth is a lot of it is fictional, the vast majority anyway.
You're right, I'm with you there. It is a cracking movie. I know I run the risk of being run out of town by the historian community by saying so. Kyle, please forgive me. But it is a cracking movie, but one that I own it, but I'm not actually allowed to watch it on the basis that I rant too much all the way through it. So absolutely with you on there. And as we were kind of putting the pre-notes together in this, like, we discovered something that that I didn't know previously about Braveheart, which is that Kyle doesn't really know a great deal about William Wallace, do you?
Yeah, we may have stumbled across the one part of history I don't actually know all that much about.
And you know about 2,000-year-old cheese?
Oh, 4,000, please.
Okay. Okay, mate, your cheese is just too modern. Well, let's take something from that then, and no doubt we've both got quite a few questions to ask. So I'm going to start off really with, so what can the actual historical evidence, rather than Hollywood, tell us about William Wallace, the man, the events?
Well, actually, surprisingly, like, there isn't a lot of actual primary sources that can tell us about William Wallace, just because it was so long ago and a lot of the records were destroyed. So the only primary sources that I could really find was the Lubeck letter, which was sent by Wallace and Andrew de Moray in 1297, as well as the Wallace letter. And that is where William Wallace visited the King of France, and the King of France then sent a letter recommending Wallace to the Pope at the time. But I mean, apart from that, the only sources that we do have like come later on, and it's like all poems about the deeds of Wallace rather than, you know, like actual evidence of Wallace the man, the person kind of thing.
Yeah.
So poetry, not paperwork.
Yes. There's a poem that was written by Blind Harry, which is a famous example of like the exploits of Wallace, and it's just called Wallace or the Wallace.
So there's a lot out there that doesn't exist. I mean, in terms of historical evidence, what is there that actually we do know that we can demonstrate?
Yeah, well, the things that we do know, of course, is the battles that took place. Like, we definitely know they happened. As well as that, the the letters that Wallace sent, there are some there. And we do know that Wallace became the guardian of Scotland because his seal on those letters said he was the guardian of Scotland, even if it was only for 1 year. So there is evidence to talk about Wallace, but the problem is there isn't enough. So this is where you then get legend building from all these people later on, like all these historians that come along later on. They try to make Wallace like this great hero, and, you know, like this is where the legend comes in pretty much.
So in terms of really, you know, the great hero, was he? Wasn't he? What's going on here?
It's hard to say because, well, the one thing that, you know, the movie got right in terms of like Braveheart is that Wallace didn't surrender, or like he never swore fealty to Edward, whereas all the other Scottish nobles actually did. So this is where like the heroism comes into it, where Wallace was like seen this as this guy who would never bend the knee to the English, and then this is where it all comes from. And as well as that, when he was the guardian of Scotland, he did try to like make some changes and reforms, like to, you know, help Scotland when they were fighting the English and things. So there is like this almost like champion of the people, that the reputation that he gets, like there is that element of it in there. But it's just, there are other sides to Wallace's character. I mean, like with everyone in history, every great man in history, there's always like a dark side to them. And Wallace certainly had a dark side, to say the least.
Can you give us some examples?
Yes, do expand.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, okay. So for example, when he defeated an English sheriff, rather than, you know, just like killing the guy and that was it, he did skin him and then used his skin as a belt. So that's like one example.
Classy.
I know. I mean, like he's trying to, you know, make up his own fashion with human skin. So fair play to him.
Yeah, and this is actually, bizarrely, this is the second, you know, external use for skin that we've had on History of Age. Our episode one was talking about bookbinding and William Burke. But yeah, the movie kind of like paints him as privately educated, can speak multiple languages, you know, comes back in on a horse, being able to speak four languages, having been off to some of the finest educations in Europe, and then comes back to become a croft farmer. Is there any part of that that's actually, you know, right?
Yes, the education is correct, but I mean, like, he didn't travel through Europe to get educated. He stayed in Scotland, and actually, as the legend goes, he was educated in my hometown of Dundee. But he, by all accounts, he could speak Gaelic, English, Latin, and French. Like, he got educated in all those languages. He could read and write them.
And this kind of rebelling against the English, it didn't come out of nowhere.
It didn't.
You know, what's his early attitudes towards the English?
Well, this is the thing. Like, the movie does make it as if, like, you know, Wallace is just a commoner. But that's actually not true. Wallace came from... He wasn't, like, high within the nobility, but he was a noble. His father... Well, there's, like, two stories between who his father was. The first story and, like, the most, like, common knowledge, or like the one that most people go to as being fact, is a noble called Sir Malcolm Wallace of Elderslie. And there's another medieval document says that his father was a man named Alan Wallace from Ayrshire. But, you know, the thing is, he did come from some wealth. So like the farm boy story, that's a load of shit. That didn't happen. He was actually, you know, he was actually a noble, albeit low down within nobility. But yeah, like he was educated and he did stay in Scotland. But when it came to the English and like the rule of the English, the Wallace clan were not happy with English rule. And the reason why is because they were in the southern belt of Scotland. So they were like the closest ones to England. So of course they're not happy. And like this part of the story where Wallace's father dies when he's young, that's pretty much true. Like, he did, like, his father died when he was a teenager. So the movie almost got that right. And he was fighting the English when his father and older brother did die. So the movie got that bit right.
But yeah, so the idea that we've got that the English just appear, they kill his wife, and he goes on a rampage. That's just not on. There's a whole load more politics going on there.
Yeah, so it's like the thing is like Miriam, like the wife of William Wallace in the movie, that's all fiction. Like there's no record of a woman called Miriam in William's life. There's no wife either. Like there's no record of that ever happening. So as far as we're aware, that's a load of rubbish. But like the sense of rebellion came from like his clan, and like, you know, his father and brother were killed by the English when he was young. So there is that personal motive behind Wallace rebelling. And it's probably why he never bent the knee to Edward in the first place, like because his father and brother were killed by the English.
Mm-hmm. One of the film things that, whilst we're speaking about King Edward I of England, one thing Braveheart quite neatly sidesteps is why he's in Scotland at all. Why is he claiming to be King of Scotland and sending all these English soldiers to occupy the country? What's the actual history behind that kind of thing? I know that's a big subject to cover, but please, try your best.
I'll try in as like few words as possible.
Okay.
When it came to like Edward being in Scotland in the first place, I mean, if you look at the situation that Edward I found himself in, like it's almost like he's fighting a war on two fronts because he's laying claims to France, and of course he's got a troublesome neighbour to the north, which is Scotland. And what happens in Scotland is that the Scottish king at the time, Alexander III, he died when he was travelling in the year 1286. And like, you know, kings die all the time, that's no problem, but it is a problem when they don't have a son. So, of course, a succession...
Yeah, common problem England's had as well.
So, like, after that, there was a succession crisis, and the Scottish nobles turned to their neighbour, the King of England, to name a successor. Now, of course...
Foolish move.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what they were thinking. Like, they should have went to France, like, if you're going to be honest. Like, go to France.
It is Scotland's traditional ally, you know?
Exactly.
Why turn to the English?
I have no idea. I don't know why they did that. Like, I could not find out why they did it. But maybe it's because, like, geography, they were closer.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something to do with that. So, yeah, then, of course, Edward sees an opportunity in this, and he chooses John Balliol, like a noble, to be the successor. But then, as soon as Balliol was crowned king, he then has to swear fealty to Edward. And then, of course, Edward, by default, becomes the overlord of Scotland. And what's amazing about this is that, you know, there wasn't this outrage straight away, because this happened in, like, 1286, and there wasn't any sign of rebellion until 10 years later, in 1295. So, like, the nobles in Scotland, they kind of grumbled about it, but they didn't really do anything about it either.
Looking at the kind of big set pieces of the movie is are the battles.
Mm.
You know, I think pretty much everybody can just move aside from the clothing. We can just park that and know that that's horrifically wrong.
Yes.
But, you know, people will look at the Battle of Stirling Bridge and the Battle of Falkirk, which are quite defining parts of Scottish history.
Mm.
I believe am I wrong? They were done completely the opposite way around as well. They've got their, you know, their tactics and everything. And don't get me started on there was an actual bridge involved.
I was just going to say I know nothing about William Wallace, but I do know there was a bridge at the Battle of Stirling Bridge. That's fairly central to the battle.
Hence the name.
That is the sum total of my knowledge. Please do carry on.
So the battles.
Go for it.
So the battles. The battles are the most annoying part about the movie because, like, you know, the clothing for a start, like, come on. Like, it looks like a bunch of savages fighting an organized army and winning, which would never have happened in the first place. So the battles, like, the best way, like, you know, like, I don't even know what to say. So, like...
This is what we like, a speechless history ranger that angry.
Yeah. So, like... the armor, that's like it's almost like disgraceful, like the way that they depicted the Scots in that way, just because like that never happened at all. The Scots wore armor. Like, we did wear armor. It's a medieval battlefield. Of course there was armor involved. And like, you know, the Scots look disorganized when they're up against the English, and you know, there's that iconic part of the movie where there's the cavalry charge and like Wallace is shouting, hold, hold. And then like they get the pikes up at the last minute and they're like, oh, it's all fiction. That did not happen. Of course, because like there wasn't a bridge. So how would you, like, you can't even have a cavalry charge across a bridge. Well, it wouldn't be very practical. So yeah, like the battle itself, like the real battle that happened.
Yeah, talk us through the real battle of Stirling Bridge, because like you say, it's not a bunch of savages that beat a well-organized army. It's a very intelligent tactical preparation.
Yeah.
And tell us about that.
Yeah, okay. So the battle itself, like the real battle, the English, like, you know, they come up and they face the Scots in Stirling. And something that I've not put in my notes, but I do know just from reading previously, the English commander was actually ill when he arrived in Stirling. So like the English were just standing around at the south side of the bridge for like 2 days, like not doing anything, which gave the Scots plenty of time to organize themselves. And what happened was when the English did finally, you know, like try to cross the bridge, Wallace did tell his men to hold. But what he was doing was he was like basically bottleneck, like he was using this bottleneck tactic where like all the English soldiers, they're all forced into this position where they're all tightly packed. And it then became a killing zone. And that's exactly what happened. So as the English are crossing the bridge, because like it's a narrow bridge, it's only two men apace to actually cross the bridge. The Scots were just waiting there, holding like their positions, and they were waiting in a nearby forest out of sight of the English. And then of course, as like half of the English army does cross the bridge, that's when the Scots unleash themselves and, you know, basically get stuck into them. And the English, seeing what's happening in front of them, you know, like they can't run away because the rest of the army is like coming towards them, like from the opposite side of the bridge. They all try to like jump in the river, but they're all bogged down by their armor and then they end up drowning. And like, it was like a total victory for the Scots. Like, I mean, when you think of the odds, it was like 2-1, like they were outnumbered, and Wallace used this genius tactic in order to like defeat the English. And yeah, it was, a total victory.
It's very much divide and massacre.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like,
which has won battles time and time again.
Parallels to battles like Thermopylae and similar battles. These are not stupid, ignorant people who are just throwing themselves at the enemy. There's thought gone into this battle plan.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, like, the Scots, like, they had to use, you know, like, they couldn't just rely on brute force because they would lose, because the English outnumbered them 2-1. So they have to come up with these tactics in order to defeat the English. And this happens throughout Scottish history a lot, where, you know, they're outnumbered and like they just have to try and like almost outwit the enemy. And one thing that played into the Scots' favour was probably like the arrogance of the commander as well. Like the English commander, like he just thought he was going to walk over the Scots because he knew he had a numerical advantage, and that wasn't the case.
The English being arrogant, never.
Yeah, certainly when it comes to Scotland, I mean, who'd have thought?
I know, right?
Well, thanks for that. I'm going to kind of direct Kyle now, because I know there's one thing that Kyle and I have like frequently discussed and debated, and it is a basic pet peeve about Braveheart that Kyle has. So the question regarding, you know, the most fictional concept ever, I believe, the Prima Nocte.
Yeah, it's the driving force of the main plot, that the English noble basically wants to have his way with Wallace's wife before the wedding. And I've not been able to find any evidence that happened in Scotland, England, France, Germany, anywhere. And it's always been described as something that, at least I've been able to find, that other people do. Like, oh, we don't do that, but the people in the village across the road, they're properly messed up. They do all this weird stuff. And then you go there, and they say, oh, no, we don't do that. It's the people in the valley next door that do that. Is there any actual evidence that you've been able to find that this took place anywhere, and especially in Scotland?
No. I've not found anything about Prima Nocte in any way. And I mean, like, I've not heard about it in any other movie or, like, any historical document that I've ever read. I've never heard of it, so I don't know where the movie came up with this.
Do you think it was just possibly a way of making Edward I just more evil? Yeah. I mean, If you are starting with a Plantagenet king and you feel the need to make them more evil, you've got something spectacularly wrong.
Yeah.
But it's one of those areas that just, you know, it's propaganda more than anything else, I find. And, you know, the rest of the movie, have you got other examples of where things that are just, you know, painted as historical fact, but are actually just not just inaccurate, but outright propaganda and lie?
Yeah, like, I mean, there is a lot in the movie that does that. So, for example, I've already mentioned her, like, Miriam, Wallace's wife, that's all pure fiction. And it's propaganda because it looks like he was fighting for love and, you know, all of that nonsense, which just wasn't the case. And there's also that romance with the French princess as well, which, you know, like, the real, the real princess was just a baby when Wallace was fighting the English. So, you know, maybe we're missing something here.
Again, it's not my area of expertise.
Yeah, like, maybe Wallace was romancing babies. Who knows?
That escalated.
Yeah.
As I understand, I mean, I'm not, it's my area of medieval is Wars of the Roses. So I'm about kind of like a good 150 years later. But as I understand it, that by the time Queen Isabella actually came to England and married Edward II, as I understand it, Wallace had been dead for 3 years by that point, hadn't he?
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. So he was already dead by the time Edward II came along. And I mean, there is that element of, like, you know, Edward II looking gay in the movie as well. Mm. Now, I don't know if that's propaganda or not. That's something that I do not know. Like, I've heard rumours that Edward I actually did something to Edward II because he was gay. Like, he got a hot iron rod and he stuck it somewhere not very pleasant. Let's just say that, like, I did read that somewhere, but I don't know if it's true. Like, I really do not know.
Yeah, and that sort of thing crops up quite a lot as well. I mean, I've never seen anything, I've seen lots of things to suggest Edward II's sexuality, but very little to actually evidence it.
Yeah, and that's what I found. I mean, like, they did get that right in the sense that Edward II was pretty incompetent because, you know, like, Robert the Bruce leads a successful rebellion against the English when Edward II is in power. So, like, they do get that right because Edward II really struggled to fill his father's shoes, like, after Edward I died.
I mean, see, it's good that you kind of bring up Robert the Bruce there, and I'd like to get the opinion of a Scottish person on this one.
Mm-hmm.
I asked this question at Stirling Castle and never got an answer from the tour guide that was there as well. And he's like, do you think a 200-foot monument to a guy that basically won one major engagement was justified when the actual victor of Scottish independence, Robert the Bruce, gets a statue at Bannockburn? Where do you sit with that?
Like, in a way, it is. Like, it is justified in a way. Just because, like, Wallace was, like, he was the one who set up the foundation, which then, like, Bruce then took over and, you know, he led to success. Like, so, like, the thing is as well, like, with Robert the Bruce, he was a lot more politically cunning than Wallace in the sense that, you know, Bruce didn't, like, just stay with Wallace and then he survived and then he took over. Like, Bruce played both sides. So, like, if the English looked like they were going to win, Bruce would, like, go, oh, okay, I'm cozy with the English now. But then, like, when the Scots are going, like, looking like they're going to win, like, that's when Bruce, like, kind of cozies up with the Scottish nobles again. So I think a lot of it comes from, you know, the fact that Wallace never swore fealty to the English. And the thing is, Bruce actually did, just to help his career. Which isn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a bad thing to do that. But, I mean, heroes are more, you know, like, they've got this, like, iron will almost. Like, that's the way heroes are portrayed a lot of the time. And as well as that, Bruce built on a lot of Wallace's successes when he became King of Scotland in 1306. For example, he used the Chiltern formations that Wallace first designed and used at the Battle of Falkirk. And it was these Chiltern formations that helped Bruce win the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314 as well. And Bruce also learned lessons from Wallace when Wallace was fighting a guerrilla war against the English. So there's always that as well. So I think, like, a lot of people see it as Wallace started the journey and then Bruce finished it.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And I can see the point there. That's the last question really from me is, and it's going to be more about the film than about the history.
Okay.
But if I were to have a favourite war film, being a Second World War nut myself, it's got to be Where Eagles Dare. Now, Where Eagles Dare is a film so packed with anachronisms, it should make me cry. And it's filled, it's like 60s haircuts. There's a helicopter in the castle courtyard. I mean, it's called a Bell 47 for a very important reason. You know, it's very, very much post-war. And, you know, the fact that Clint Eastwood can go through what is a 35-minute gunfight without a single reload should have my blood pressure cracking the ceiling. And yet it doesn't. And I speak to other historians, even some like leading academic historians, who you ask them what their favourite war film is. Oh, Where Eagles Dare by an absolute mile. You get a similar sort of thing with like Kelly's Heroes as well, with all its 60s hippie drug-smoking tank commanders and so forth. And it's like, why does Braveheart get pilloried in the historical community, and a film like Where Eagles Dare gets adored?
To be honest, I actually haven't seen Where Eagles Dare, so I can't really comment on it, unfortunately. Although it's on my...
Oh, you need to change that in your life.
I know, I really do. Like just the way that you described it, it sounds like the kind of movie that I really want to watch.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, you're going to have something within kind of your love of the ancient, the old, the sky. I mean, you know, things like I Love a Knight's Tale. Yeah. Jousting is not like that, but oh my god, what such a great film.
Yeah. Like Troy, the Trojan War in the Iliad didn't happen anything like that film, but it's still a really good film.
Yeah. I actually agree with that. Because like in the Iliad, isn't it like it's like a series, it's like 10 years of war, right? So the Greeks, like, they go back and forward like every year, isn't it?
As I understood the Iliad's like 1 month in the 10th year. Of the,
it's when all the exciting bits happen, though. War.
So Natalie Haynes told me I haven't read the Iliad in years.
It is
so.
The bit where Hector basically dies. But the film doesn't happen like the book, but it's still an amazing film, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I really do love that film. Actually, it's a classic movie for me to watch a lot. Yeah.
So do you think there's anything particular about the historian community that would like make them, they would turn on Braveheart, but not necessarily turn on something like Troy or A Knight's Tale or Eagle's Dare? What is it about that film that riles everybody up?
With Braveheart? I'm not sure. Yeah. Like, I really don't know. Like, I mean, Braveheart itself, we all agree it's a great movie. It's just that historians seem to really dump on it for all of the inaccuracies. There's just something that I really don't know why, because, like I said, I enjoy it for entertainment. Like, when I, like, watch these movies, that's what I try to do. It's more like I take it with a pinch of salt and just enjoy the ride rather than, you know, like, try and scrutinize it.
I wonder, and, you know, feel free to comment, I wonder if it's the way that the film opens up with almost having a go at historians. Because it does that, you know, and history is written by those that have hanged heroes, and at which point, you know, any historian's going to go, no, history is written by people who've spent a lot of time in archives looking at facts, thank you. And it could be that.
It could well be. And I mean, like, the opening sentence, or like one of them, it's straight up a lie, because like it says, like, it talks about Malcolm Wallace, but then like when Robert the Bruce is narrating over like the opening scene, he calls Malcolm Wallace a commoner, which, you know, wasn't true. So you're just like, oh, there's strike two already.
They call Edward the First a cruel pagan as well. Sorry, I'll just repeat that.
It was half right.
They call Edward the First a cruel pagan, but he found out he was the king on the way back from a crusade.
Yeah, I know, right? And that's the one thing as well. Like, the movie does not mention anything about Edward the First actually going on a crusade.
Yeah, I mean, that man was a pious warrior king. Whatever else he was, and the religion, you know, you can't say he was a cruel pagan. You could say he was a cruel father.
Yeah, yeah, I mean,
you could say he was a cruel invader. Yeah. You can't say he's a cruel pagan.
Yeah, because it's, like, fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, as well as that, like, it goes, like, again, with that opening statement, like, the movie makes, it then goes on to say that, you know, for his son, Edward I chooses the daughter of the King of France. But then it kind of hints towards the fact that Edward I wanted her rather than having his son with her and things. You're like, this is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's having some anachronisms in the background. Helicopters, you know, slightly different costumes, you know, the fantasy-looking armour. And then there's straight-up lying to the camera and the audience. I suppose that could be where it comes from.
Yeah, it could be. And I mean, like, the dress code as well, like, I mean, it's weird, because in Scotland, everyone loves the dress code for, like, all the Scots and Braveheart. But, I mean, it's factually, like, it's not factual. Like, they didn't dress like that.
And like you say as well, and we said earlier on, turning up to a battlefield in a kilt, a shoulder throw and a small shield, you wouldn't even make it to... you wouldn't even be able to pick the pike up. The longbowman would have just taken you down straight away.
Could I make a wild suggestion? Did the costume department put them in kilts to remind the audience that this is Scotland and it's just visual shorthand?
It could be, actually. Yeah, it could well be that. But I mean, like, surely, well, mind you, like, the accents aren't exactly the best either. So, yeah, maybe it was something to do with that. And, like, they didn't even film the movie in Scotland. They filmed it in Ireland as well, which is another blunder.
Yeah.
you know what looks just like Scotland? Yeah, Ireland! Apparently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Americans, like, when they're coming over, they're like, oh, Ireland, Scotland, the same thing, right? That's probably what they're thinking.
You know, they've both got some nice scenery. Yeah, if you're American, what's not to like?
Exactly, right?
Well, thank you very much, Dean. I mean, that was cathartic, to say the least, because, by God, I do enjoy a damn good Braveheart rant. So yeah. I've got up this early this morning to do just that. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank Dean for appearing on History Rage. I'm sure you would too. So, Dean, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're quite welcome. If you'd like to hear more from Dean on his specialist subject of ancient China, then his podcast, The Chronicler, is available on all good podcast platforms, as well as YouTube. Mm-hmm. And you can follow him on Twitter at TheChroniclerH1. And we'll have links to all of those in the show notes. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Paul Babble.
And I'm at Kyle G History.
And you can leave comments, thoughts, and please send your own history rages using the hashtag History Rage. If you've enjoyed our work, then please subscribe. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.